This is Ahval Online, meeting point of accurate news and free comment on the current affairs of Turkey. Welcome to our podcast series.
Hello and welcome to Talking Turkey. I'm your host, Ahval editor David Lepeska, and with me today is Mehmet Gür, widely seen as Turkey's most renowned chef who now oversees nearly 20 restaurants in Istanbul and beyond. Hello, Mehmet, and thank you so much for joining us today.
Hi, and thank you for calling.
You are welcome. Opened in October 2005 on the rooftop of Istanbul's Marmara Pera Hotel, your restaurant Mikla was named for the Viking word for Istanbul, Mikla Gard. So it was from the start a blending of East and West and a bringing together of your own identities in a way as Turkish and Finnish Swedish. Mikla has been named among the world's top 50 restaurants, and it will mark, I believe it's 15th anniversary in October.
True.
Yep. Yet when it opened, I read that you have said that you felt it wasn't adequately grounded in Anatolian culinary traditions. So you began researching, investigating, and examining the traditional dishes, styles, and methods of Anatolia, crisscrossing Turkey to taste and study just about everything. I read somewhere that you tried 950 different cheeses. After years of research, you came out with your manifesto called The New Anatolian Kitchen, which is the driving force behind much of your culinary thinking today. Before we get to those ideas, I just wanted to discuss a bit your travels across Turkey. How did you know where to go to find the best or most unique dishes like this? I've read that you have a special mercimek from Malkara that you appreciate. Also, I read that you and your friend Tangur Tan dressed casually, almost humbly, and that you had to cover up your tattoos to gain the trust of locals and farmers. So please, if you would give us a sense of how you decided
where to go, and
what would happen when you got there. Yeah.
I'll try to, and I'm also going to touch a bit on what you said that when we first opened Mikla, you were very nice in saying in what you said. I was a little bit more blunt, saying it really lacked character and personality when we first opened. Okay. It was a great restaurant. Nothing wrong about that. It was a great restaurant. We had good food, great service. Business was great, but it lacked a lot of personality and character, I think. And I think it's a little bit because of my background. I didn't know Turkey enough. I wasn't born here. I didn't grow up here. I lived here just for a very short time in some of my high school years before I left for the U.S. Mm-hmm. Before that, I was living in Sweden. So I really didn't know the region, the country, the people, the ingredients, the methods, none of it. I mean, I've been here on summer holidays and all of that, and great, followed my grandmother and grandfather, whatever. But it was only after I moved here that I started discovering the depth of the region. So it was more or less into my fifth year that I decided to revamp the whole everything that we do about it. And that was after the beginning of the research. Tango, who had worked in, he actually worked a cold line in another restaurant that we had. But he was a great guy, super intelligent, very curious. So he went off to study gastronomy at school in Polenzo at the University of Gastronomic Studies there. He stayed for about 4 or 5 years. He worked a little bit with slow food there. And then he came back to Istanbul and I hired him full time as a researcher. And in the beginning, we had no idea where to start. I mean, I needed to find better ingredients, better tasting stuff. I mean, you know, Istanbul is a huge city. Mm-hmm. We have access to good stuff, but again, in an enormous city, there's not a lot of farmland in the close vicinity. So we had to go beyond. We had to get on the road more or less to figure out what was out there, and that's what we did. Jumped in a car and went. When Tango first started doing the research, he's from the Aegean region, so which is fairly easier to approach if you're an outsider. It's when you go towards the east where it can become a little bit more tricky. You really have to know the people and the lay of the land a little bit more, the culture, the customs a bit more. But in the beginning, so we started with the Aegean, but we had no idea what we were doing. Literally, we had no idea. And we just hit the road, got to know people, got to know products, started with the low-hanging fruit. the honeys, you know, the fresh fruits and vegetables, etc., etc. And well, everybody here knows that a good Karst Gruyère, which is a type of cheese, the best one is from Karst. That pretty much everybody knows. But who among all the cheesemakers makes really the best one? That's what we needed to find. So we quickly discovered it wasn't about the product. It wasn't about the field or the land. It was more about the people that were making them, the people behind it, the farmers, the producers, the cheesemakers, etc., etc., the shepherds. They were the important ones to find. And that was a trickier. So we really had to get into it. And as you said, some of the regions we go to are very conservative. So it meant no jeans and T-shirts, so shorts, flip-flops and T-shirts, cover up tattoos, getting rid of piercings if we have any, and dress a bit more conservatively and get into it. And that's how we really got to know the wonderful people that are there. And it's funny how the people that really make the best products are the ones with the biggest hearts, the one that really treat the family, the friends, the farm, the farm animals, or the earth the best. We have yet to find someone that has a great product that is really an idiot or that's really a bad person. it always good people. So that's how we started.
They're putting that passion, that love into their food.
That's it. They're honest, good, honest people. And once we get to know one of them and gain their trust, they recommend us or they refer us to a friend, and then to another one, and then to another one. And it's like that where hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of people, it all become one big family now. We have people, some of the people making, we have, there's a guy in central Anatolia, in Çankırı, that makes a hot chili paste with chilies from another producer that we found in Antakya. And we introduced the two of them, and one of them sent the seeds to the other one, and they're planting the chili peppers, and now he's making super good chili paste in central Anatolia with chilies from southeastern Anatolia. So all of these relationships have started as well, which is super exciting to see. I'm kind of bringing down some of the barriers that very often in this part of the world exist among the villages. And, you know, they a lot of people keep to themselves because there's a lot of ethnicities, there's a lot of religions, there's a lot of stuff going on. And so people tend to keep to themselves. But this food has helped us actually bringing them together somehow, which is super exciting.
Is there any particular taste or flavor or farmer or experience or method that struck you during these travels, like when they were happening, that maybe altered your thinking and it still stays with you today?
Well, I can't really recall one super like specific event, but a lot of them did. I mean, the first thing that it does to you when you get out and travel, it humbles you. I mean, you realize you really don't know anything. You think you're this hotshot chef, whatever, because people tend to talk to you, they interview you like we're talking now. And I mean, as you're aware, chefs, they tend to have an ego and et cetera, et cetera. But once you get out there, you realize you don't know anything. I mean, most of the homes we go to, they cook far better than I can ever dream of cooking. And the knowledge about the product is tremendous. Maybe not necessarily scientifically or whatnot, but they feel the earth, they feel the weather, they feel the climate, they really feel it because it's been carried through generations. And that is something that struck me. I started looking at food in a simpler way. Maybe it has to do with age a bit as well. I don't know. But in the beginning, you're trying to be this flashy, you know, coming up with funky techniques and whatnot. When I look at the cooking we're doing now, it's very humble. It's very straightforward. We're not looking for any other fancy, super expensive ingredients. We're just looking for the best tomato, the best lentils, or the best whatever it is that we need to use. Picked at the right time, taking well care of, and then we try to alter it as little as possible when we cook. And that I think has changed a lot since the beginning of our research. In the beginning, it was very much technique focused, very much precision, degrees, temperatures, times, etc. Whereas now it's a lot of feel into it. I mean, the whole saying of there's this usta, which means master,
yeah,
which is what you call someone that really cooks well. So the chef de cuisine here he's the usta or she is the usta. And that is, I think, is the utmost respect we can give anybody. And I have yet to reach that level. I might be, let's say, the one that can think, have the thought behind the whole idea, the whole project or the concept, whatever. But it's the people that really do it that they're at a completely different level. And that's something that it really humbles you. I mean, it grounds you, and you realize that there's, you still have a lot to learn.
Speaking of learning and maybe becoming an usta, one of the more interesting points I thought you made in your manifesto is that the new Anatolian kitchen is constantly evolving. Please, if you would, give us some detail about the thinking behind the new Anatolian kitchen and then how it has changed over the years.
It has changed a lot, and I'm hardly using it, actually. It's something that maybe it's the first time that I'm talking about it openly, which is kind of fun. I've been thinking about it a lot, especially now during the pandemic, and sitting at home a lot, thinking, going, like, really pondering about different things and see where I'm going with a lot of these ideas. But when I first came up with the idea, I wanted to create a way for the next generation of chefs, because there are a lot of new cooks coming out from schools, and it's become like everywhere in the world this cool thing to do. And in the beginning, I think like a lot of developing countries, they are looking outside their own region for inspiration. A lot of the Japanese chefs or Scandinavian chefs, whatever, were the idols of the young cooks here, which is okay, but you also run a risk of losing the culinary identity of the region if they forget to use their own backgrounds or their own geography or their own history. So I was trying to think up a way where it would become a cool thing, because if you think of a 20-year-old, 18 to let's say 22-year-old kid, it needs to be cool. It needs to be sexy. It needs to be fun. There's no other way you can get them to do it. So we had to kind of get the local cooking, the Turkish cooking or the Anatolian cooking, whatever we call it, we had to get it to become cool. So I started looking into that. That was like one of the ideas, because that was the only way I could get them on board to carry the flag forward. Mm-hmm. So we came up with a couple of fun things. We made it cool, etc. We tried to share our own ideas as a team, and slowly we got there. We told them that it's okay that you're completely breaking down any barriers and any sayings that are very strong. And I would say a lot of cultures that have been rooted, that are very rooted. But at the same time, you have a lot of, let's say, conservative, both religious and just in general thought. It becomes very hard for the younger generation to break down the barriers, to tell their mother or father or their older in the neighborhood that they're wrong, or that they don't agree with them, or that they want to do something completely different. Think of music in the old days when rock and roll first came out, and then later on, I mean, you had it's same thing through art, through music, through everything. And the food here really needed that. But at the same time, we cannot just push everything aside, because it's been evolving nice and slowly, like everything. And the culture has been slowly evolving and slowly been shaping. But people refuse, very, very often people have refused to accept that. They want to stay in the status quo to say, nope, this is it. Nothing ever changes, whereas they themselves change every single day without maybe realizing it. So I wanted to help the next generation kind of push that change without disrespecting the past, so they have something solid to build on, to build on a solid foundation, but then so the building is strong, but then come up with a nice design on the building, not just visually, but as a thought. So this was pretty much the design, the idea behind it. Look at the characteristics of the region. I mean, it has to be very up and down. It's a lot of, I mean, everything here is up and down. It's never a monochromatic landscape. If people are happy, they're super happy. If they're sad, they rip the hair out. It's like that with food as well. If it's spicy, it's spicy. If it's sweet, it's sweet. If it's sour, it's super sour. So all of that is very up and down. And that is something that I appreciate in the food of the region. A lot of microclimates, a lot of wild food, either foraged or whatnot. And people in the cities have gotten, they have lost the touch of it. So we tried to underline all of this in this manifest. And I remember saying that once we get this whole contemporary local food, call it Turkish, call it Anatolian, whatever you want to call it, as the main restaurant scene, and it becomes cool for the younger generation to go to Turkish restaurants again, then I think I'm done. Then I think we've succeeded. Yeah. And right now, when we look at all the new restaurant openings, that's what we see. People cooking, focusing completely on the local food, on the ingredients, on the smaller farmers, on the smaller producers, but putting their own character into it, putting their own background to it. So if their grandparents are from southeastern Turkey, the food becomes a bit more geared toward that. If they're from a town in the Aegean, the food become evolves around that. So we really see that very strongly in the restaurant scene. And this, I think, will affect not only the restaurants, but the way people eat as well. So now I think, well, do we really need this manifest now? I doubt it. I think we're there, to be honest with you. I think we're there. From now on, I think it will evolve into something completely different. And the reason why we call it New Anatolia is because I didn't want to call it New Turkish, because New Turkish becomes too nationalistic. There's a lot of exclusion when you say like Turk or Turkish in this region. We need to be much wider. We need to grab any and everybody that lives on this land and even beyond the borders.
So this is why, I mean, this is going to be my next question, actually. The manifesto mentions kind of avoiding ethnicity, nationality, and religion. Is that why?
Definitely. This is the reason why we picked the name. And actually, I'm not the one who found the name. It's an Italian journalist, Gabriele Zanatta. I remember I was in Milano doing a presentation, and he was talking. It was a translation, live translation there on stage. And he was like, he was talking to me in English, and then it was going on in Italian, etc. So we go back and forth with questions, and then suddenly he says, New Anatolian Kitchen in Italian, that much I get, right? And I just stop. What did you just say? Because we never thought of it. I mean, now everybody, it's out there, so it's very easy. It doesn't seem like this super genius thing to find. But back then we really had a hard time, because specifically back then, New Turkish meant something almost in favor of the current government. And it became very politicized. It became very ethnically focused. It became almost religiously focused as well. And that's something that we definitely want to keep out of, to be as inclusive as possible. And that's because that's the richness of the region. So when he said New Anatolian, we definitely wanted to be new. We definitely wanted to be from this region. And then again, Anatolia has a lot of other deeper
their Georgian influences and Levantine influences, yeah.
And that as well, but also as in the society here, and being Anatolian is being truthful. It's being hard worker. You're not fooling anybody. You're being a good, honest guy if you're an Anatolian, Anadolu in Turkish. Mm-hmm. So it has a lot of meaning to it. So it's not just as simple as just a geographical region. It has a lot of sentimental value as well for the locals, and no one that's a true Anatolian guy or girl is a bad one. It's a true, honest person. So all of that kind of fit into what we're trying to do, being open and open to all of the past and hopefully to all of the future, and not limiting ourselves to the little border. I mean, the Turkish borders have been like this for the past 100 years. And before that, it was completely different. And I'm sure in the next 100 or 200 years, it will change again. So 100 years in history is not that long. So I'm trying to look at, especially in this part of the world, where there are thousands of years of history and a lot of religions, a lot of ethnicities. And why not embrace it all? Let's say it might sound a bit like Kumbaya. Let's sing Kumbaya together. But why not embrace it all for we're talking food at the end of the day. And food is at the center of us all our lives. So they all influence each other. So let's be open to them. That was the thought behind it.
Right. Anatolian cuisine updated for the 21st century is great, but I think you'll agree that preserving and maintaining traditional dishes and methods is just as important. I noticed, maybe you know this as well, Istanbul today has only one remaining dairy shop that makes its own kaimak, 105-year-old Karakoy Ozut. Yeah, it's and speaking of kaimak, traditionalists will say it needs to be made with water buffalo milk, but more and more it is made with pasteurized cow's milk and with added preservatives that make it last longer but make it taste like plastic, basically. Also, as you know, Istanbul has been losing its esnaf lokantalara, or tradesmen restaurants, for years. And these are places that have served like fantastic soups and other traditional dishes for decades at really low prices. They're for everybody. I'm sure you could list many of these troubled culinary traditions. And this is some of the thinking behind your Ruhun Doysun initiative and TV and video series, which is that people have lost the connections to the origins of their food. Please tell us a bit more about this concept and how you are working to revive and maintain these traditions.
Again, I'm not one of those that's pushing on the brake when it comes to cultures or preservation. But I believe that to preserve a culture, it needs to be living. If you want to preserve the kaimak maker, if you want to make sure that the men and women who are making the kaimak or even the best yogurts and whatnot are using the water buffalo and not the water buffalo that was just shipped in from Italy. We're talking the water buffalo breed that's been around in this region for a long time. That's also very important because now you have mozzarella, Italian mozzarella, which is great, that's being done here with the guy making the cheese that's Italian. The buffaloes were shipped in from Italy and now they're making mozzarella.
Right.
If you use that the milk from those buffaloes, it's not going to be the same as the ones that they have been traditionally using for kaimak. So unless kaimak, the usage of kaimak is a current thing that people do today and it's prized as a high-end product, and this is very often through restaurants in today's culture. Before it wasn't, maybe it was something else, but in today's culture in many cities it's the restaurants, the chefs in the restaurants and the journalism done around these restaurants and the food trends, etc., that create these trends or that keeps them going. So unless we can take this kaimak, for example, and make sure that it's becomes a high-end product, and so people pay what that kaimak producer deserves, then it's bound to be lost. Mm. There's no way we can create a museum restaurant. You only go if the restaurant where you would, esnaf lokanta, so it's one of my favorites in Istanbul. I mean, I really, really enjoy good esnaf lokantas, which is you know, your everyday lunch joint, let's say, but with the best selection of fresh, properly made food. If it's not cool to do that, or if it's not an easy way to do, if it's not easy enough to do, if it's not, maybe not esnaf lokanta isn't a good example. But let's go back to kaimak. I think it's better to describe the whole issue. If we don't make sure that we use kaimak in high-end restaurants that's properly made, it's bound to disappear. It's bound to become just a supermarket product. We have to make sure that we pay the artisan that's making it. It's a very commercial issue that we talk about, and sometimes people think I'm losing the romance of it, but I'm trying to be very realistic. It's For the cheesemaker to survive, they need to get the proper price for the super product they're making. And that's always going to be higher than the commercially made one with pasteurized cow's milk.
And probably most restaurant owners aren't willing to pay that premium.
Exactly. So unless we create this buzz around it, so the customer asks for it and makes sure that there's a difference in the store, in the restaurant, and later on in the stores, then there's no way that the shopkeeper or the restaurant owner is going to pay the difference.
That's interesting. Because it's almost as much my responsibility as it is yours.
Exactly. And I'm more like the messenger. I'm the one trying to tell you as a customer, say, look, this is what we're using at Mikla, a super high-end restaurant in Istanbul. We're using this kaimak. Make sure you keep on doing it as well. Mm-hmm. And then it becomes a trend, and then other restaurants start using it, et cetera, et cetera. And we reverse the whole process. I think that Gravier, that is a good example, how even the migration has reversed. Now people are moving back to Kars, to Boatepe Köyü. That's the village that makes the best cheese, that Kars Gravier cheese in Turkey. villages that previously moved away from the village because there was not enough jobs or schools or anything. Now they're moving back. There are more animals than there were before. They're making more cheese than they were before, and they're moving back and they're learning the craft because now they get a proper price for it. It's become a trend again and people are using it. So that, I think, is a really good example of how you can, through contemporary trends, reverse and actually save the tradition. It doesn't mean that you're messing it up. If you're not creating any musicians, let's say, classical music will die unless you create people. You get people excited. Some of them will go in to get into rock or rap or whatever it is, but some will get attached to the classical music. And if you don't have anybody that knows how to play the piano or the violin or whatever it is, then you're not going to have any music left.
Well, it's interesting that you say that. In interviews, you have said that one of the lies they told Turkish children was that Turkey didn't need to import any food because it produced everything. This is even more of a lie today, as I'm sure you know.
Exactly.
Turkish agricultural production has been falling for years, and Turkey today is more dependent than ever on food imports. Part of your manifesto was about supporting quality farming, as you say. So I was wondering, how troubled do you think Turkey's agricultural sector is today, and how could it be turned around and fixed?
Oh, it's very troubled. It's very troubled. I think that it's never been in this state. There are a few really cute kind of places, but that's not the norm. Some of the, like the example I gave about the cheese in Kars, it's a great example. It's very romantic. It's super exciting, but it's not the norm. The norm is that the big guys come in, they wipe it out. The Monsanto comes in or other seed companies come in and then they wipe it out. And that's one thing. And then another thing is that they have allowed mining companies coming in and just ripping through, unfortunately, just ripping through a lot of the area. Some of
also, there's the story of the hazelnut of the hazelnut farms.
Hazelnut, you have the hazelnut Italian company coming in and taking over the hazelnut production, pretty much. So there's a lot of things that have been done wrong. I think that Turkey has been a developing country for years now. It still is. And when you look at developed countries, developed societies, let's take Sweden or Germany or France, for example. Being a farmer is okay. It's a good job. You're a good, honest person if you're a farmer. Whereas here, it's very often been associated with being the lower class, with being just a simple villager kind of, even
peasant.
An expression of peasant. That's the word I was looking for. And they're just putting people down. Oh, you're just a peasant. You don't know anything. Mm. And so people have wanted to, I mean, people have moved from the villages to the cities, a huge migration. The cities have just exploded, I mean, the size-wise. And it's not because people have been making out like rabbits. It's because of the migration. Mm-hmm. So what happens is they leave the land in the village or in the smaller towns. They move to the big cities as work pretty much in construction or another slave-like jobs in the big cities. And of course, the younger generation, they don't want to, it's not cool anymore. They don't have the schools or anything to hang, any place to hang out or to do anything. So it's much more of just a simple economic or production issue. It's very deep down an issue that has to be fixed more of a, on a social level. And looking at farming in just in simple economic terms is suicide. We still know that globally, still the smaller farmers that feed the world. We know that, and they're very efficient in how they run the farms, much more efficient in the long if you look in the long term than the larger companies. And this is valid pretty much anywhere in the world, and same thing here. But it's very difficult. How do you keep a young family, a young man and a woman in the village, if they cannot live on what they make off the land, and if they cannot send their kids to the school, if there's no health facilities? I'm not talking about a full-fledged hospital, even something called Sağlıkoca, which is like the health center, let's say, that was very common in the villages, or at least a cluster of villages have one in common. a cluster of villages have a school in common, used to have a school in common, and more than just a primary school, keep on going a bit more as well. So losing all of this through trying to become an industrial country without regarding the foundations of the land, it's been a suicide. And this is not just something that's been going on with the current government that's been here for quite some time, but this has been going on maybe for the last 50 years or so. So it's easy for a lot of people today just to blame the current government, whereas this is something that if you look back into, like historically, something that's been going on for a very long time. This government, previous governments, et cetera, et cetera.
Turning to the restaurant business, Mikla reopened in early July, I think, after a long layoff for the pandemic. It's been open for about a month now. How's it going so far? Are people coming out to eat at Mikla and your other restaurants?
Yes. Let's talk about Mikla. The other restaurants, I'm no longer a shareholder. I was lucky enough to sell the shares right before the pandemic started, to be honest with you. So the coffee business that we had, it's going really well. I know that the new owner is really happy with it. And the casual dining, the casual restaurants that we had, they're also doing fairly well, not as well as the coffee business, because the coffee business has a lot of retail as well. So it makes life a little bit easier. And then when we look at Mikla, for example, which is a high-end restaurant where we had a lot of international customers, almost like 70-80% of our customers were international visitors. Mm-hmm. So in the beginning, that was really the biggest dilemma for us, like how are we going to run this business? So we changed the focus a bit in our communication. We also let them know that, yes, you've trusted us for 15 years. They know that we are this very, very rigid when it comes to hygiene, et cetera, et cetera. And this is something that we've been known for. That we work with the smaller farmers. The moment you support us, through us, you will support our business partners, as we call them, all the smaller producers. And we just let people know that this was the case. And in the beginning, we only opened 3 days a week to start with, to focus it on 3 days, and it worked really well. We are doing pretty good. We opened up the fourth day now as well last week, and that's also been good. It's worked really well. Of course, the business is not where it was a year ago when we look at the number of people in, because we are very rigid when it comes to the distance between the tables and the chairs. Mm-hmm. I know there's a lot of regulation, but a lot of people in the business, unfortunately, do not follow those regulations. But just this last Saturday night, there was someone that wanted a table on the terrace. And because the terrace we have is amazing.
Yes, it is.
yes, it is, really. I wasn't in the restaurant, but I called in and said, look, is there any way you can like chuck a table down somewhere? You know, this typical kind of restaurant reflex that we had. And my manager was very happy. He said, no, I cannot, because then the distance between the tables will not be following regulations. So I'm sorry, I cannot help you out.
You must be losing significant capacity, though. 40-50% or something?
Yeah, about 50%. But we kind of, what we did, we extended the hours a bit. We kind of stretched them a bit. It's okay. We have a very understanding landlord. I would say probably the world's best landlord. Yes, they're always like, Turkey has always gone through, not always, but very often goes through various crises. Being the coup attempt in 2016, or bombs going up, or financial crashes, et cetera, et cetera. So we are fairly flexible when it comes to this. And my landlords, thank God, they're like, yeah, whatever. We're in this business together. I mean, I've been renting this space for the past 15 years, and we really support each other. So they've been great. And this time as well, they were super good. So I'm one of the lucky ones, to be honest with you. I mean, the team is on. They're all happy. As I said, we're really the lucky ones. The only thing we changed a bit was the menu. We tried to make it a bit smaller. We change it more often, but a smaller prep list, just to make sure that we don't have any waste whatsoever, because we are very much like efficiency and also cost focused. So we want to make sure we don't throw stuff away, not just for financial reasons, but it goes, there's so much effort and energy that goes into producing food. So it's just a waste of throwing it out. So for various reasons, we refuse to throw food out when there's so much people dying or starving from no food. So this is something that's in our core, not to waste anything, being it energy or food or water, whatever. So it's been pretty good. It's been pretty good. I can't complain. Obviously, it's not super. It's not like it was last year. I mean, last year we had an amazing year, one of the best we've had in a long time. But it's still okay. We're doing good.
Sure. Okay. Good. You now oversee kind of a small culinary empire: books, TV series, a line of appliances and kitchen tools, the cafes and restaurants, including one that opened in Helsinki, I think, 2 years ago now. So I wonder what's next. Maybe a return to the United States. Maybe something else.
Well, I mean, I always have a contact with the U.S. I mean, my former school is there. I mean, I was born in Finland. I grew up in Sweden. I lived here for a few years. Went to a French high school, and then got my baccalaureate, and then went to the U.S. Got my college degree there. Worked a bit there, and then came back here, etc., etc. And now I'm working with projects all around the world. I'm doing like one place in Dubai, one place in that was, it's still under construction, and then the one in Finland, then some other spots in the world, etc., etc. A couple of more projects coming in, and also I'm in a lot of contact with my old school, Johnson & Wales in Rhode Island. So I don't know if education is something that I'll go into a bit in the future, but I think now I got Mikla on one side, and then on the other side I've started doing a lot of consulting and a lot of training and things like that gives me a certain amount of freedom, but also the excitement of creating new things, of coming up with new ideas, because each project is a new idea. Whereas restaurant in itself is quite repetitive, to be honest with you. It's quite repetitive. You come up with an idea, you create some food, and then you keep on going at it and making sure it's perfect. Mm-hmm. Whereas when you think up new projects, new ideas, it's really exciting. So collaborations between various companies, etc., etc. It's exciting, and obviously books or TV and things like that. It's fun. It's, to be honest with you, it's more for the fun of it than anything else. And I think that's probably what I'll be doing in the near future. Will I move to the US? I doubt it. Will I always have a foot there? Yes, for sure.
Okay. Well, best of luck with these new projects. I look forward to hearing more about them. Renowned chef Mehmet Gür, thank you so much for your time and insight. It's been a real pleasure talking to you.
Thank you. Thank you. It was great talking to you.
You can follow Ahval News Online podcast series through Apple Podcasts, Spotify, YouTube, Google Podcasts, SoundCloud, and Spreaker. All you need to know about Turkey is here, for your ears, mind, and attention. Thank you for listening to our podcast.